Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal, Özil. Marca Mesut Özil. El 1-1. Esto es el Arsenal.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, look, you knew I was going to do something, right?
I had an inkling. Let's go that far. Let's
do it.
Good morning. James McNichols, morning. Andrew says, goodly morning. The goodliest morning you can have.
Wow. Goodly morning to you too. That was amazing.
Goodly morning. Yeah, well, you know, we had to put something together to celebrate the momentous occasion of Arsenal winning a game of football again. Get the fuck in.
I know. It's such a nice feeling to be sitting down to do one of these and it not be bad news. It feels like such a sweet relief.
It does. I mean, and the thing about it is that we've had so much to talk about in these after these games when things have gone wrong. You know, the podcasts have been really very long. So we're going to keep this one to about 14, 15 minutes and that's it, just to make up for it, you know?
Find some balance.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is. It's been a difficult week or so, hasn't it? I mean, not just our own results, but other things have happened.
No, they haven't. No, they haven't.
La 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 la
la la la. Nothing's happened. Can't hear you.
And now, yes, listen, we have something of our own to celebrate at the very least.
Yes.
So thank goodness.
Yes, we do. A European final. Fantastic. And performances over two legs against Valencia that I think we can take some real heart from. You know, things haven't been good domestically. We can all see that. But in Europe, we beat Napoli at home. We beat Napoli away. We beat Valencia at home. We beat Valencia away. You know, they're not necessarily the greatest teams of all time, but I would suggest, I'd say this to you, James, that, you know, if you were to put, for example, Valencia against Leicester or Wolves or Crystal Palace, you know, they might well beat those teams. So I'm saying that in terms of the opposition we've lost to in the Premier League versus the opposition that we've beaten in Europe, I don't know what the connection is now. I've lost my train of thought completely.
No, I know what you mean. I almost sort of can't bear to think about how good we can look against a Valencia or a Napoli as compared to how bad we can look against teams from sort of the middle regions of the Premier League.
Yeah.
It sort of makes my head hurt when I try and break it down. But I am choosing to look on the bright side. And it is quite remarkable, really, that given our away form, we have won both away legs as well as the home legs against those teams. And those two teams as well who, let's not forget, dropped out of the Champions League into this competition. So, you know, I think with all our fears about how would we actually fare in the Champions League, we've knocked two theoretically Champions League teams out on our way to the final.
Yeah, so look, tell me this. How worried were you in the opening 15 minutes? Because I have to
say, extremely.
As much as we're going to celebrate what happened, I think it's fair to point out that the start that Valencia have, I mean, I don't think they could have asked for anything better. If they had a game plan, that was certainly it. Score early, put us under pressure, take advantage of the fact that we're not particularly good away from home, and and, you know, put the shits up us. It was very close to being 2-0 to Valencia because the guy, he hit a shot. I think that shot was going in, the one that hit his own man, having already gone ahead. Yeah. And at that point, you know, the tie would have been, well, level, but we would have been, as it stood, going out because of the away goals rule, which, of course, has played a significant part in European results this week. That didn't happen, actually. Never happened. So it was a little bit worrying in the opening stages of the game.
Yes, it was. And I guess that kind of is a consequence of what you could call the gamble that Unai Emery took by playing two strikers. I'm not sure that is a gamble, really, in our position. I sort of think it's what he absolutely had to do.
Yeah.
But in doing it, you know, it meant that defensively, he was asking, really, Lacazette and Aubameyang to sort of split and almost cover the wing-backs in those wide areas. And I think it left the wing-backs quite exposed, quite isolated. Ainsley Maitland-Niles had quite a difficult time in that first 20 minutes. And, of course, their opening goal actually came from a chance he sort of had in the opposition penalty box, the way we recovered from that. So, yeah, we looked a little bit ropey. Fortunately, we just had that bit of goal-scoring quality that was enough for us on the night. But definitely at the start, especially with all the comebacks that have happened this week, I was thinking, please, God, not another comeback.
Yeah, not another one. I mean, I'm just watching the build-up to our first goal here, and it comes not long after Rodrigo smashed a shot, really, a couple of inches wide of the post. And what was interesting was it was so against the run of play. Yeah, here's the long kick from Cech. Goes up in the air. Lacazette flicks it on. He's no right to win that header against those guys. And what a brilliant finish from Aubameyang. But I downloaded the game again. I'm watching on Spanish television. And they're just sort of, they've cut to somebody, a lady, I don't know who it is, but they're talking about something other than the game. And all of a sudden the guy goes, oh, watch out. Here's Aubameyang. Goal! And it sort of sums up how kind of against the run of play it was.
Yeah, it's interesting, the camera work, because I don't know if you got this on your pictures last night, but during the build-up to Valencia's goal, opening goal, it cut to Emery, like, midway through the move, and he was sort of had his arms out as if to be like, where's the midfield? and then they cut back to the move, and they consequently scored. And then, yeah, the same with that one. I mean, it's interesting, people, I'm sure we'll get onto this subject, but there's a lot of chat about the goalkeeper and Cech's tendency to go long. Well, this was one of the occasions where it paid dividends, and we went direct to the strikers. I think Lacazette deserves massive credit for the way he fought for that ball, competed for it. He did that all night. It's weird because they're a traditional strike partnership in some ways, but the hold-up player is the smaller man, and that's Lacazette. And he, you know, he makes a nuisance of himself, he puts himself about, and he gets the flick on. And the finish from Aubameyang is brilliant, really. I mean, I think it's up there almost with the goal he scored against Spurs at the Emirates Stadium for sort of an instinctive first-time finish outside the box. Yeah, fantastic goal. Fantastic goal, and immediately settled the nerves. And sort of as soon as we scored, I thought, I think we're probably going to be okay here.
Yeah, it was the timing of the goal was so crucial because Valencia were very much on top. And if they'd scored another goal, you could have seen pretty easily how, you know, with our recent record and with confidence not quite as high as it would normally be or you'd like it to be, how we could have gone into our shell. So the timing of that goal, not just good for us, but bad for them. I think it really knocked the stuffing out of them, to be honest. Not completely. Go on.
No, just something we've talked about on the show is how Arsenal do seem to struggle when they have a setback. You know, when they fall behind, they're not that good at responding. But I thought in this game, we went behind, we did get that goal straight away. Then, you know, we got in front, they pegged us back, but it wasn't too long until we were ahead again. For some reason, in this match, we were able to find the resolve and have those moments. So that was a big thing. A lot of that is down to the strikers, I think. You know, we talked about leadership quite a lot on the last show after the Brighton game. And I think there are different kinds of leaders. And I thought the strikers really led by example in this match.
You know, in this match and in the first game, because we talked about it last week, didn't we, when we said that basically the two strikers took it in their own hands to go and win that game for Arsenal. And over the course of the two legs, they've scored 7 goals. They got 2 assists between them. You know, it's really a remarkable contribution. And, you know, the team selection that Unai Emery made was not a surprise at all. I think that's what we were basically all expecting based on, you know, the context of the game. You know, us taking a 2-goal lead into it, I wasn't really expecting him to go with a back four. Team selection was exactly what I thought it was going to be. But again, it was, I think it was more to do with the individual quality and desire of our strikers. And I don't want to take, and I'm not trying to take anything away from the manager who's got us to a European final. That's not my point here. I just feel like in these two games, they've been the driving force behind the results and the performances. It's not really, you couldn't say, well, this was a tactical masterclass from Emery. He got us to play in this specific way. I think really these two guys have just taken both games by the scruff of the neck, and the quality and character that they have means that when that's effective, it's really, really effective. Yeah. And it's served us so well.
I don't think anyone could really argue with that. I mean, even this performance, which, you know, is really one of our highlights of the season, especially in terms of the result and what it signifies. We conceded 2 goals. We looked, to be honest, like we might concede 1 or 2 more. Yeah. You know, Valencia had other chances in the game. I thought our midfield was pretty ragged at times and, you know, stretched quite regularly. But the strikers just made the difference, and they are players of top quality, to borrow a phrase from Harry Redknapp, and they, you know, I think they're Champions League strikers, essentially, playing yeah. Europa League team. And I think I said after the first leg that I think we have the best forward line in this competition, and well, we've benefited from it massively, and obviously the final looms on the horizon, but you wouldn't bet against either of those guys making an impact in that game too, the way that they've taken this competition by the scruff of the neck.
Absolutely not. So I think the way we played the rest of the first half was quite pleasing, particularly in the final few minutes of the half where we just needed to see it out. And
we hit the post as well, didn't we, Lacazette?
Oh, yeah, true.
In fact, that was the moment, I think, where I thought, Aubameyang's really on it tonight.
Yes.
This is where he sort of had the ball on the right wing and kind of skipped outside his man, played the perfect pullback, and Lacazette just denied by the width of the post. But it was such good play for Aubameyang. Mm. You know, for a player who, we talk about his goals, but sometimes his all-round game isn't quite at that level. In that moment, I think you saw that on the night it was.
Yeah, I think the best way I could describe his performance is Henry-esque.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were shades of Thierry Henry in that performance, not just in terms of the goals he scored, but how he scored the goals. You know, the way he lashed home that third goal was fantastic. The movement, the pace, the power, the build-up play, as you said, creating for Lacazette. And even in the second goal, which we got early enough in the second half, he picked up a loose ball, drove on, lost it, but didn't give up. He didn't give up on it. And
wins a tackle, doesn't it?
Yeah, wins a tackle. The ball squizzes out there to Torreira, who fires it into Lacazette. And actually, you know, we'll, I guess, pour more praise on Aubameyang than Lacazette today, because I think it really was a 10 out of 10 performance from Aubameyang. But when you give the ball to Lacazette in that area, in the box, even though he's got his back to goal, we've seen him do it so many times this season. He's got this amazing ability to find space and turn and get a shot away. And I think that was a really brilliant goal. And obviously, the timing of it, the importance of it, it meant that Valencia needed 4 goals in normal time to go through. And that gave us the right cushion, the kind of cushion we needed to go on and win the game.
Yeah, I mean, it's that low centre of gravity, isn't it? He sort of shifts his body weight so brilliantly. And once he finds that bit of space, he strikes the ball so well. And that's been a feature of his game all season. Mm. As he banged in that goal, I just reflected on, you know, the player that he looked when we signed Aubameyang. And, you know, I know he was carrying a knee injury at that time, but the difference in him in the last 18 months, in Lacazette in particular, is quite amazing. I mean, the way in which he's sort of faced up to the challenge of English football and the move to Arsenal and everything that entails, and the way he's responded, the physicality that he has shown, the attitude that he has shown, I think, you know, given all, I think there were reservations about him when we paid all the money we did for him, and Arsene Wenger sort of looked at him for a few years before the deal actually went through. And his first season in some ways sort of played into those ideas that maybe he wasn't quite of that elite level. But I think his development in his second season is amazing, really amazing. It's a huge, huge improvement. And yeah, he's just become a fantastic all-round forward, really. And I thought the goal was brilliant. And I actually think it's a bit of a shame in some ways that he only ended up with the one goal. And we're probably going to talk about him a bit less than Aubameyang, because it was a really, really good display from him. And a lot of it was about the partnership, I think.
No, I think you're right. And I think in some ways, the fact that he has dovetailed so well with Aubameyang has contributed to that development that you talk about in his second season. You know, he looks a more confident player, but he also knows he's got a strike partner or somebody that he can play with who understands him. You know, I think that's kind of rare. We can talk about partnerships a lot, but sometimes they develop over time. But other times, two players just get each other and they just get it straight away on the pitch and off the pitch as well. I think that has a big impact, you know.
And what a response as well to the signing of Aubameyang, which, you know, in some ways looked like it signalled Lacazette almost being relegated to the substitutes bench. There's a bit of luck involved, I guess, in terms of the chemistry that they have on and off the pitch. But, you know, neither of them has said, well, look, you're my rival here, they've made it work, and they've made themselves absolutely instrumental to our fortunes.
And it's absolutely the best part of our team. There's no question about it. You know, when you look through from front to back or back to front, you can see where improvements need to be made this summer. And, you know, those are things I guess we can talk about, you know, maybe in this podcast or in the podcast to come between now and the transfer window opening and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, you look at those two and you think, well, really, is there anybody else in the Premier League who has as good a partnership or as good a pair? I mean, obviously the forwards at Liverpool are fantastic, but I think they're sort of in a different system. They're not quite as what's the word I'm looking for here? Maybe they're, Liverpool aren't quite as reliant on them as we are on those two, if that makes sense.
No, and also in terms of sort of centre forwards, you know, I think they've got Firmino, who's fantastic, but beyond that, there's a bit of a gap. You know, in terms of having two central strikers, two pure goal scorers, that not that that's all that they do, but, you know, in terms of having those two centre forwards, I think we're unparalleled in the Premier League. You know, maybe Aguero and Jesus, but they don't play together. And when we signed Lacazette in that summer, it's worth remembering, Chelsea went out and bought Morata, United went out and bought Lukaku, both for bigger fees. And at the time, they were kind of viewed as maybe signings from a tier above Lacazette. Well, you know, a couple of years on, I think it probably looks like we got the best deal in that scenario. I think they are fantastic. And, you know, all season long, we've seen people sort of almost sort of feeling like they might have to choose between them.
Don't care.
I understand it a little bit, because I understand the idea that maybe I in an ideal world would play with one striker and with, you know, more wide players. But with what we have available, our best team undoubtedly has these two on the pitch.
Yeah, and can we and just... I suppose, go on.
I suppose the fact that we sort of talk about, oh, well, would you sell Lacazette or would you sell Aubameyang tells you, well, you could. There are people who would like these players. You know, Barcelona are linked with a move for Lacazette. You know, you think any club in the world would probably take a goal scorer of Aubameyang's reliability. So there aren't other areas of the pitch where Barcelona are looking at our centre-halves or central midfielders.
Well, that's exactly it, isn't it? People are saying, well, we've got to sell these guys. You know, how do we sell Mustafi, for example, or if we wanted to move Ozil on, how do we sell Ozil given his contract and all that kind of stuff? Whereas you could see very easily how you could sell Aubameyang or Lacazette. The point I want to make, and I think you've just made, is that, you know, we cannot, with all the work that we have to do, take away the best thing about this squad and this team if we really want to make progress. So it's about maybe finding players this summer who can help those guys be even better. If we can find creators, if we can find passers from midfield, people who can make chances for them. Because, you know, over the course of these two games, I know they had a bit more service last night than they did in the first game. But really, it's about them dragging this team and pulling this team over the line in terms of their own contributions. And I think, you know, when you look at our domestic form in the Premier League, one of the big problems is the fact that we don't create enough chances for our two extremely good strikers. So I think that's where we really need to concentrate, or certainly one of the areas we need to concentrate on this summer.
Yeah, I mean, look, 48 goals between them this season, I think, speaks for itself. And, you know, in a team that doesn't have a huge variety of goal scorers, we've lent heavily into their ability and relied on them to an extent. And they have made a difference. And, of course, at this stage last season, you know, we got to the semi-final, but we didn't have Aubameyang available. He was cup-tied in Europe, I think.
He was, yeah.
And he was eligible to play last night, and what a difference it made.
For sure. OK, Valencia got another one back. Not particularly great defending from us again. Any issues with anything? I mean, the goalkeeping?
It was a good ball, I thought. I forget the name of the midfielder. The guy used to play for QPR.
Rodrigo? No, Parejo.
Parejo, yeah. It was a good ball, but I thought Kolasinac was quite switched off. You know, it was in between Monreal and Kolasinac, and the runner wasn't really tracked by either of them. And the goalkeeping, maybe. I mean, I would say both the goals Valencia scored, they got a bit of luck with deflections. You know, the first one, the cross deflected perfectly into the guy's path at the far post, and this one, it sort of looped up, hit Rodrigo. It wasn't the most convincing goalkeeping I've ever seen, but I don't know if it's realistic to expect Cech to save that.
No, I don't. I mean, I think it was just maybe a goalkeeper with slightly quicker reactions could have saved it, but I think you know, there was an element of bad luck from our point of view. Bad defending. I think Monreal was bad. Socrates wasn't great either in terms of letting the guy run past him. I'm just watching the replay again here. It is a very good pass between the defenders. Here we go. Yeah, Monreal. Yeah, Cech is just a little bit slow, you know? But
Yeah. It's one of those where we look at it and we say, our defenders are at fault. But, you know, if it was Mesut Ozil playing that pass, we'd be talking about the quality of the pass.
So of course, yeah.
I do have a measure of sympathy with the defenders there. But, yeah, I mean, Cech, it wasn't a particularly convincing moment. I'm sure we've probably got questions
we do.
About Cech, so we'll get on to that.
OK, so still in a very commanding position, Arsenal. Maitland-Niles then provides a fantastic ball for Aubameyang. The movement of the striker was brilliant. When you look at where he started from, when Maitland-Niles has the ball out on the right-hand side, he just ghosts between the two central defenders. Great little bit of play on the right from Maitland-Niles as well, who I thought, you know, started. It was difficult for him at the start because of how exposed we were down the sides, but really grew into the game. And not for the first time he's put in a good ball this season. I mean, it's a good little trick. Here's the pass, and there's Aubameyang. Like, the pace and the power and just the desire to get on the end of that ball, brilliant.
Yeah, I loved this goal, actually, I have to say. It felt to me a little bit like an Invincibles goal almost, because it was so much about pace and power and movement from Maitland-Niles on the wing, absolutely blitzing past his man with a lovely bit of skill and acceleration, and then Aubameyang's acceleration in the box. It's a classic Aubameyang goal. It's the sort of chance that he gets in every single game because his movement inside that 18-yard box is so good. And yeah, a really good contribution from Maitland-Niles, who I thought had a difficult task and a tricky night defensively in some respects, but that was as good as anything I've seen from him, really. That little 1-2 step past his man and fizzing the cross into the near post. And so that made it 3... Was that... No, that was 3-2 on the
3-2
night,
3-2 on
it?
The night, yeah. So that made
it 6-3 on aggregate.
Yeah. You know, so, I mean, game was well and truly done and dusted.
Safe,
I mean, it was safe
point.
Anyway, really, but...
Yeah.
You know, we didn't take our foot off the pedal, which I like, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. And as I said before, we responded to, you know, potential setbacks in pretty convincing fashion. You know? So once they got their second goal, I'm trying to look at the timings now, but they scored on 58. Yeah, Gamero got his second, and then within 10 minutes, 11 minutes, restored the lead. So I really liked that aspect of our game, and every time we came under threat, we just sort of went back to leaning into that forward quality, and it worked.
He did change a couple of things. Mkhitaryan came on for Mesut Ozil. What was your take on the Ozil reaction to the change? I mean, he looked really unhappy about being taken off, but he seemed to be more unhappy with the Valencia fans than with Emery.
Yeah, it seemed to change, didn't it? Well, the commentators, certainly on the English commentary I was watching, were sort of suggesting, oh, this initial reaction was to the idea that he was being substituted. Then
Which
he got
I think
booked,
it was.
I think.
Yeah.
He got booked, didn't he, for taking his time, leaving the pitch, which wasn't really sort of necessary time-wasting in the circumstances, given the cushion that we had. It wasn't like it was the last 10 minutes or anything. And then by the time he reached Emery, he'd sort of given the old shush finger to the Valencia fans, and then him and Emery seemed sort of to have a little embrace on the touchline. It seemed like seemed okay between them. So I don't really know what to make of that. As far as the change goes, I thought it made sense, really. I thought Ozil had been pretty quiet in the game, and Mkhitaryan was fresh, and I actually quite like what Mkhitaryan does in that role behind the strikers. He came on in the first leg and was involved in the third goal and was involved in our last goal in this game too after coming on in that position. So I think it suits his ability to find space sort of in the channels, really. And he sort of pops up everywhere, which I think works for him. So, yeah, I thought it made sense. Ozil, not sure. I guess he just didn't want to come off, did he? And then I think he turned his frustration on the Valencia fans, maybe rather than his own coach.
Yeah, strange little thing, I thought. It was, you know, I don't know what. Maybe he's got some previous with Valencia fans that we don't know about from his time at Real Madrid.
Well, that's it. Of course, he was a Madrid player, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe they were giving him a hard time as a consequence of that.
Yeah, maybe so. Guendouzi came on, Mustafi came on for Kolasinac. It didn't really change very much. And then, of course, we scored that fourth goal, Aubameyang securing his first hat-trick for the club. Nice ball from Mkhitaryan, nice movement, of course, from Aubameyang as well. And the finish, we don't always associate him with power when it comes to his finishing, but there was a lot of power in that finish. It really just fizzed past the goalkeeper.
Yeah, I think when he's in that right-hand channel, he does tend to go for power more. There was a goal at the Emirates Stadium earlier this season. I forget who it was against, but a similar strike, which went in at the near post, you know, high into the net. But that was a brilliant take. Nice move as well. I think Guendouzi was involved. Mkhitaryan, Aubameyang with the step over, was it? And then Mkhitaryan finding him with the little reverse pass. Lovely goal. Really lovely goal. And a fantastic way to seal a hat-trick and set the seal on just a really good evening for Arsenal. And one that they sorely, sorely needed. I think one that we all sorely needed.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I mean, it really does change your mood, doesn't it? And there was a nice little bit of a scrap at the end as well, which was great. I enjoyed that.
Can you figure out what went on there? Could you tell?
Basically, I think Lacazette took offence to somebody giving him a kick. Maitland-Niles is there, pulls the guy away, and then Maitland-Niles gives the guy a two-handed shove in the chest, at which point Gabriel came over and got involved and started swinging arms at Maitland-Niles, and then I think it all just kind of calmed down. But I love a little bit of that. I like a little bit of argy-bargy.
Yeah, and I like that Maitland-Niles is a young guy, a quiet guy. He was prepared to sort of get involved a little bit when it all kicked off. I also found it quite funny how the camera kept sort of cutting to Gabriel for his sort of shell-shocked reactions throughout the game.
And Coquelin.
Just nice to see a man associated with Arsenal on the receiving end of that.
Do you
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rather than the other way around.
Absolutely, yeah. You could see their dead eyes behind. Just looking here at Gabriel. Koscielny's come over and Gabriel's wagging his finger as if like some terrible thing has happened. But, you know, he'd start a fight in an empty room, Gabriel, when he's on the pitch, of course. I think he admitted that himself before the game. But look, you know, we can't underestimate the importance of this win, not just for the team, or the fans or Unai Emery, but, you know, for the club and what it might mean for the future, because not only do we have a chance to win a trophy, we've got a chance to get back into the Champions League, which is is so, so important. Obviously, the trophy is the single most important thing, but when we talk about what we need to do this summer and how we need to rebuild, that was a strange intonation, but, you know, having the Champions League money is a very, very important part of that. So let me just ask you a quick question while I've got it here. Can you tell me what all of these clubs have in common, if you can?
Okay.
Lokomotiv Moscow, Hoffenheim, Young Boys, Galatasaray, Victoria Pilsen, Club Bruges, and Shakhtar Donetsk.
I don't know. Are they UEFA Cup winners?
No. All of those clubs have earned far more money than Arsenal from European football this season.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's a list. I mean, we are in 33rd place. We've earned somewhere in the region of 20 million from the Europa League. I think there's an 8 million euro prize for winning the Europa League, which would bring your income from the Europa League to around 28 million euros, which is, you know, a lot of money. But when you compare it to what teams at the top end of the Champions League are going to earn,
whoever they might be.
Our good friend Kieran from Swiss Ramble suggests that the teams in the final would be earning somewhere in the region of 100 million euros, plus there's another, I don't know how much it is, 4, 5, 8 million euros for winning the final. So that tells you what the gap in revenue is. You know, 25%, basically. If you go all the way in the Champions League, you get 25% of that if you go all the way in the Europa League. I don't really have any expectation of us going all the way in the Champions League if we get in there next season, but certainly that level of income would have a profound effect on the business that we could do in the transfer market this summer. And that, I think, is why, you know, we can talk about football and things being the same and familiar failings, but that for me was one of the big frustrations of top four. Top four isn't just this ephemeral thing. It's not just a status thing. We don't want to talk about top four being a trophy, but when you have top four in your hands and you have that level of income that you can use, or that it's the only thing that we can use to reinvest in the squad, right? Is that income, because that's the way this club is run. It's self-sustaining. So what we generate, we can spend. That's what's played into this frustration of how things have gone in the Premier League and the fact that we haven't finished in the top four, because it's impossible to overstate how important that revenue is if we want this club to progress. What's wrong with the way I'm saying things today? To progress. I don't know what's happening. But, you know, that's sort of why things have been so frustrating. So to have this opportunity to A, win a trophy, and B, get into the Champions League by winning that trophy is fucking fantastic. Because this is kind of like our safety net of the season.
It is, yeah. It's the backstop. But and they're the Brexit finals, aren't they? All English teams. It's great that we've got that to look forward to. I mean, we've seen that so many times, our season saved by a cup final. I mean, that was a recurrent theme, wasn't it? Of course, a few years ago.
Yeah.
Not too long ago. And it does mean that suddenly, I mean, it's a long way off, isn't it? It's about 2.5 weeks, isn't it?
29th of May, yeah. Actually. So it's like 2 weeks from Wednesday.
Yeah, so it gives you something to keep the hope alive, really, and keep our chances of Champions League qualification alive, which I completely agree are vital for this club. I think the longer we're out of that competition, the more damaging it will be, both financially, in terms of our status, I think in terms of morale. I think these players, you know, they want to play in the Champions League. They must be motivated to play in the Champions League. Someone like a Lacazette, someone like an Aubameyang. And I think you could see a bit of that in these performances. Top four would have been great. It would have been fantastic to be going into that final not worrying about Champions League qualification and just thinking about the trophy. But if it provides a little bit of extra incentive, then so be it. I mean, it's a huge opportunity for a little bit of redemption and to give ourselves. Can I stop you there?
I think it's a lot of redemption. I think it's a lot of redemption, yeah. Not a little bit of redemption. I think it's a big fucking gigantic. It's a skip full of redemption if we're going to go down.
It's a skip full of redemption, yeah. And I do believe that a lot of the ills of the last few weeks probably would be treated with a little bit more sympathy if we come back from Baku with a trophy and, you know, a place in the Champions League under our arm. But look, it's going to be a nightmarishly nerve-wracking occasion because there is now so much riding on it, and against a London rival as well.
Yeah, would you feel less nervous, less pressure if it were Frankfurt, who were in a commanding position in the penalty shootout, and then fucked it up?
And they had a great chance in extra time as well. I don't know if you saw it, but an incredible opportunity to win it. I was sort of willing Frankfurt on, even though they look like a very decent side. And in Jovic, they've got one of Europe's hottest properties at centre forward. Well, we've got two, so I guess we shouldn't worry too much about that. But I just think, you know, losing to Chelsea is so much more frightening a prospect that losing to Frankfurt.
I have to say, I was looking at it, and as excited and exhilarated and as optimistic as I am to be in a European final, and I think it's an amazing thing, I can't say that the image of Olivier Giroud supplicating himself on his knees in front of the Arsenal fans, crying with shame, having scored the winner for Chelsea against us, didn't go through my mind while some people still sing the Giroud song at him.
Yes. Well, I think he's the joint top goal scorer in the Europa League.
He is.
He's been playing most of the games for Chelsea in the competition. So very, very good chance we'll come face-to-face with him. Very good chance we come face to face with Eden Hazard in possibly his last Chelsea game. It will be a tough game, no doubt, and one that I'll be watching, you know, sort of through my fingers. But we've beaten Chelsea in a final not too long ago, and we all thoroughly enjoyed that day.
And we've beaten Chelsea this season as well.
Yeah, and I thought even away and from home against them, we gave a decent account of ourselves and probably should have got a bit more than we did. And if Unai Emery has a strength, it is these games against so-called big opposition.
Yes. I'd rather play Chelsea in the final than Crystal Palace or Wolves.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I don't know what that says about us, yeah.
Maybe it will play to his strengths and to a certain extent the team's strengths, you know, if you look at our record this season.
Yeah.
We certainly have to hope so. But look, I know it's not the Champions League, but it is a European final. And I think there's a lot of younger fans who don't remember Arsenal winning a European final. You know, you've got to go back to the early 90s, isn't it?
94. The Cup. Yeah, 94. So
it would be a great thing. It's a real blot on our copybook as a club that we haven't won more European silverware. And what it would mean in terms of getting back to that top table of European football, I think would be huge and would give us a far better chance of pushing on and being there next season. Because, you know, Chelsea have had their transfer ban upheld. So that's going to really, you know, cause them problems, I think, next season. And I mean, they're going to be limited in the transfer market. Manchester United, there's question marks over what's going on there with their technical director, with their coach, Ole Solskjaer. If we can get into the Champions League and if we can recruit smartly, then I think we have a real chance to push back into that top four. But
yeah, I agree.
A lot rides on that match in Baku.
No, it absolutely does. But I think you're right. There is an opportunity which we can take if we obviously win that final. That's in our hands as much as it can be when you're playing a game of football. But there is the opportunity to push on and to invest and to make this squad better and stronger and hopefully make the chances of finishing in the top four next season even better. And of course, I think the other thing that if we did get into the Champions League is that I don't think the Champions League is as difficult to deal with in the final part of the season as the Europa League. You know,
you don't get the Thursday Sunday thing.
No, you don't. I mean, people say, well, what's the difference between Wednesday and Saturday and Thursday and Sunday? Well, the difference is sometimes you play Tuesday Saturday or Tuesday Sunday. So you know, you do have more time. I think there's one less round as well in the Champions League. You know, it is huge for the club this summer. So a lot rests on that particular game. And I think as well, we should point out that since we had that terrible half in Rennes, when we went down to 10 men, and Unai Emery, I think, got it wrong in terms of how he dealt with being down to 10 men. Since then in Europe, we've been really very good. We beat Rennes at home. We should have beaten Rennes, what, 5 or 6, when you look at the chances that we missed. We beat Napoli without conceding a goal, home and away. We've beaten Valencia. You know, I know we conceded a couple of goals, but we scored 7-3 on aggregate, you know, over the course of two legs against a team, a good team, not a brilliant team, but a good team, who've been very difficult to beat at home this season in La Liga. You know, so we have to give credit where credit's due.
I don't think anyone else has put 4 past them this season.
Yeah.
I think only Atletico have put 3 past them, according to Unai Emery. So, yeah, we've been excellent, really, in Europe since that Rennes match. And that bodes well, you have to hope.
Yep. Yeah, you do. Right. Have you got anything else you want to talk about on the game? Because I think we've got a pile of questions about all kinds of things.
No, I think let's just crack into the questions and see where that takes us.
All right, we will take a break. We're going to come back in part two with your questions and more right after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome back to the Arsecast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions that you send to us on Twitter at GunnarBlog and at ArsBlog on the ArsBlog Facebook page, facebook.com/TheArsBlog, and also on the ArsBlog Patreon member Discord server. It's a chat server you get access to if you are an ArsBlog member on Patreon. You can sign up for $5 a month at Patreon.com. I'm all over the place. Patreon.com/ArsBlog. I just want to point out one thing or say one thing, because we have had about 7 trillion questions along the lines of, would you take Arsenal losing in the Europa League final if it meant blah, you know, that terrible thing, that thing we can't talk about, you know,
if
that
it meant
thing,
that thing didn't happen.
Yeah, if it meant that thing didn't happen.
I've seen a lot of questions along those lines.
There's a lot of that. I don't want to answer that question because I don't feel like it's an either or the choice is binary, and I don't want to have to think about that other thing, right? So let's hope, listeners, friends, comrades, for a positive outcome in both European finals. All I can say is that in the days after the Europa League final, whatever happens with Arsenal, I am going to be a mug smasher for a little while. That's all I can say.
Yes. Hashtag you'll never walk alone.
Yeah, we are all mug smashers now.
We are all mug smashers. Somos todos mug smashers. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mesque un mug smasher.
It sort of doesn't... It's almost impossible to contemplate how bad the bad thing would be, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah.
It is. So let's not, because this is a day of happiness and celebration because we're in a European final, and let's not dwell on what might be potentially the worst thing that's ever happened in the world. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to start with a question from the Discord chat server. It comes from Arsenal FCTX. And he says, there are many things we can discuss heading into the final in Baku. But really, the biggest question is, do you play Cech against Chelsea? Especially if he's going there to coach starting possibly the day after the final. Now, I'm not sure he's going to go and join Chelsea the day after the final because, you know, they'll be off on their holidays and stuff like that. So... but there is some talk of
they'll be going off to the Nations League. Don't forget about the biggest competition in world football, the Nations League.
Oh, yes, of course.
It's got the semi-finals. Mm. Yes, he said, didn't he wants to be a coach and not a goalkeeping coach, but a coach.
Yes.
I don't think that matters at all, really. I think, you know, ultimately, he doesn't want to lose his last game, whoever it's against. And by the way, what an incredible kind of narrative coincidence it is that what could be his final match is against the team where, you know, he probably played his best football.
Yeah.
I find this one really difficult because I think that the decision is already made, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think Cech is going to play. I think Cech knows he's going to play. I think Leno knows Cech is going to play. And I think Unai Emery knows what he's going to do. So it feels a little bit academic to debate it. I would probably still go for Leno, I have to say. If it were my choice, I would go for Leno. And I even think it doesn't really rob Cech of an occasion. He's still part of the squad. He's still part of that night.
It does. You know, you can say being part of the squad and what have you, but if you're sitting on the bench for a European final, you know, as magnanimous as you would like to be, you're not really involved in the way you would want to be. You don't, I guess you don't really feel like if you're an outfield player, potentially you can come on and make a contribution. The only reason you're coming on as a goalkeeper is...
Well, Leno might go full layman in the final. We don't know. Yeah, you're right. I suppose it's different for a goalkeeper. Your chances of being involved are limited, but don't put it beyond Arsenal in a European final. I suppose I sort of don't really... I think I... Call me cold-blooded. I think that is still the call I would make. But I don't think it's what's going to happen.
Yes, I don't think it's what's going to happen either. And it was interesting. I think Tim Stillman made a good point on the Arsenal Vision podcast about how we're maybe not considering what it might do to Emery's standing within the squad if he rolls back on a decision that we all believe to have been made. And
true.
A commitment perhaps that he has given to Petr Cech, you're the European goalkeeper. I wonder if he has explicitly said to him, you will play in the final if we get there. But I suppose the fact that he has played him in every round to the final suggests that he's made that commitment to him. I mean, yeah, if you're cold-blooded, I think you play your best goalkeeper. And I think Leno is our best goalkeeper. So, yeah, look, I think I would also go for Leno, and I'd feel bad. Because the dream scenario is Petr Cech winning against Chelsea in his final game as a professional, lifting a trophy for Arsenal, being involved. But in order to give us the best chance of winning the game, I think Leno is what I would do. But again, like you say, I think it's academic. I think he'll pick Cech.
I think he will pick Cech. And I would say, you know, as much as we were all sort of given to worry about this, we've won cup finals before with the likes of Fabianski in goal, with...
Ospina
in goal against Chelsea, let's not forget. And I don't think... I've said this before, but I don't think the gap between Leno and Cech is as big as perhaps the gap was in the past with our first choice and a deputy. So, look, There is a romantic part of me that would absolutely love Cech to win this game and go out on that high. And find it very funny if he denied Chelsea the trophy in his last ever match. But yes, if it was a purely footballing decision, I think you know, you'd want, as a fan, you'd probably want Leno to play, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah. Do you think there's any chance that Aaron Ramsey might be fit?
I've been thinking about this. I mean, it did seem a little bit premature when they were like, his season's over. It must be a bad hamstring injury, mustn't it?
Mm.
Given that they initially said 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And when was it? When did, what match was he injured in?
Napoli away.
So that was the 18th of April.
Right. So you're talking...
So that's already 3 weeks.
Yeah. So it'll be 6 weeks. I wonder. You know, I remember when Lukas Podolski had a hamstring injury, a really bad one that kept him out for maybe 3 months.
Yeah, it was 12 weeks, something like that.
But if I'm right in what I remember, he was stretchered off the pitch. He was in bits. And I think Ramsey just kind of walked off. So I wonder, I mean, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? Even if he was just fit enough for the bench.
Yeah, it would. I actually wondered as well. I mean, I think it feels like a decision's been made on this, but I thought there was an outside chance Danny Welbeck might get back playing before the end of the season. But I've not seen him involved with the under-23s or anything like that. So with that level of match practice, I think it's difficult to envisage him being in the match day squad. But Ramsey, you know, given that he's been playing all season, it is a prospect, isn't it? It's a possibility. I hope Unai Emery's asked about it in his pre-Burnley press conference, because, yeah, I sort of hope against hope that it could happen.
Yeah. You know, you'd feel a bit more confident even with a 75, 80% fit Aaron Ramsey to come off the bench in the last 20 minutes if we needed him.
Even if it is just that, 20 minutes off the bench, I think, you know, he could make a real impact. Mm. So, because I will say our bench didn't look particularly strong last night, I thought.
Not from an attacking point of view, you know. It's,
no, no.
There's not a lot there that you would necessarily have huge faith in to turn things around if you needed it. So, so yeah. Okay, well, look, fingers crossed. Maybe they get the old horse placenta out or whatever the hell kind of poultice they can make up and make things, just slap it on his hamstring and send him out there.
Yes, indeed. That would be lovely. Yeah. This question comes from the Discord, and it's from Brownlow03. We had a few questions about this. Damien Clarkson on Twitter as well. But Brownlow said, what do you think Ainsley Maitland-Niles should do next season in terms of his position? I think he's filled in as well as could be expected at right-back and right-wing-back, but I don't believe he's good enough or will ever be good enough to be a long-term option there.
Good question. I don't know. I don't quite know, because unless we go out and buy a right back of some description this summer, or promote a right back of some description this summer, I feel like Maitland-Niles is going to have to start the season there. Hector Bellerin's injury, it's normally about 9 months, isn't it, for a cruciate? So he did it at the end of January or mid-January. You're probably talking September before you can start bringing him back in. And at that point, you also need to be cognizant of the fact he's been out for 9 months and not just slap him back in and play him every week in every game. So I'm not 100% sure. I think there was another question here. Let me just see if I can find it. It comes from Tiernan Mullins. And let me know what you think about this. He's on Twitter at Tiernan Mull. He says, when Bellerin is fully fit, how would you feel about moving Ainsley Maitland-Niles into a midfield three with Torreira and Xhaka / new signing? I like the sound of that new signing guy. Do you feel the system could fit in with both Lacazette and Aubameyang? So what do you think about maybe moving him back into the centre of midfield, where Arsene Wenger has always said he sees Maitland-Niles, even though Maitland-Niles said he kind of fancies himself as a winger.
Yeah, and I have to say, on the, I think, was it the there was only an FA Cup game against Blackpool, I believe, where he started on the on the wing. But I thought he was quite impressive on that occasion. And when you see what he can do last night in terms of his acceleration and his crossing ability, that becomes a tempting prospect. I actually like Maitland-Niles as a wing back. I think in a five, you know, with wing backs on either side, I think he's got a lot of the attributes, and I think he could have a real future there. I'm a little bit less convinced of his capacity to play in a back four. And I think that's where I would like this team to go in the future, is towards a back four. So it's a little bit of a concern for me, maybe, that that's not the most natural position for him. I think my inclination is, given our spending restrictions and our budgetary issues, that if we can make a right back of Maitland-Niles, and given that it's still fairly early in his sort of development into that position, I would probably persist with that. I feel like we need him most there, and it seems to me like a sensible solution. I'm not against the idea of him getting games in central midfield too at some point, because when Bellerin comes back, you know, I think he'll be first choice on the right hand side.
Yeah,
but I think Maitland-Niles at this stage, to me, he seems like someone who, whose value is as a bit of a utility player, someone who can provide cover in a couple of areas and save us a bit of money and improve our homegrown quota. I sort of think that's kind of where he is for now. And if he moves into a central midfield position in the future, then so be it. But I don't feel the need to immediately start playing him there. Mm. That's kind of how I see it.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, sometimes versatility can be a really good thing, but it can also be something of an impediment to a player, because they never nail down a position that's well and truly their own. And we find ourselves in a position where we're saying, oh, well, he played there, but that's not really his position. Oh, he's played over there today, but that's not really his position. And then we end up in a situation like we had with Oxlade-Chamberlain, for example, who was playing here, there, and fucking everywhere, and nobody really knew what his best position was. Well, I think we kind of knew with Oxlade-Chamberlain where his best position was. It was sort of in central midfield. Because when you think about the good games that he had for us, or the games where he stood out, it was in there. But there was never any real desire on anybody's part to see him given a run of games there on a regular basis. Certainly not by Arsene Wenger. He only ever used him there when he had to. So I think he is still very much in the development phase of his career, but also at some point he's got to try and define who he is and what he wants to be. And that can happen with discussions, you know, with the manager and everything else. So I think next season I would like to see a move to that.
I think that's true, but I don't think we're quite at that point yet. He's 22 in August, so he's maybe a little bit older than you might imagine he is, because he's been out on loan, you know, and he's sort of part of the Iwobi generation, really. I think the thing with me with Maitland-Niles is I don't look at Maitland-Niles and think we must find a way for this guy to get into our starting 11 every week. For me, that's not what I see. I see someone whose value is sort of as a squad player, you know, in the same way that, like, a Danny Welbeck, I know he's an older player, but, you know, I wouldn't be like, well, he wants to play centre forward, therefore he must play centre forward every week. I'd sort of see him as a kind of jack of all trades to an extent. Mm. And Maitland-Niles is at the moment, is I regard as that sort of player too. I think we do need something else in central midfield, though. And that's the part of the question I definitely agree with. And I also am curious about the idea of a central midfield trio. I mean, it's something Emery did a few times earlier this season. I don't know if you remember, and he took quite a lot of stick for it at the time, because I think of when he deployed it. But he did go with sort of in a couple of games with Guendouzi, Xhaka, and Torreira. And I think that when he did that, I think he was moving towards something he might like to do. So sort of a back four with a midfield three, and then something more attacking ahead of that. The problem with that is, how do you get two strikers on the pitch? You know, it's not... I mean, I suppose you go to something like the Diamond, which we have used quite successfully. But Yeah, I think last night was an occasion where I thought Xhaka and Torreira could have done with an extra player helping them out. And, you know, we had Mesut Ozil playing ahead, but in some ways someone deeper might have been more valuable to them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I felt maybe Ozil could have dropped in a bit at times, but, you know, really.
It's hard. You don't know what his instructions are.
Yeah,
as well,
of course. So you
don't know where to apportion blame for that, really.
Is it my question or your question? I think it could be mine because I just co-opted one at the end there.
Yeah, go on then. It's yours.
Okay, so this comes a couple here. First one from Matthew Cooper, who's at Cooper M on Twitter. He says, having convincingly harpooned our Premier League season so that Sunday has little to no importance, is it even worth putting Lacazette and Aubameyang on the bench? While Henry Powell, who's at AFC Henry P, says, do we rest everyone at Burnley now and give the likes of Nketiah and the rest of the kids a run out?
I think you might as well rest pretty much everyone. I mean, I have a little bit of a concern that Aubameyang is going to want to play to try and get the golden boot.
What is how far behind is he?
I think he's two behind, maybe. Let's have a look.
I'm looking it up here. Yeah.
I mean, I know Mo Salah is out in front on 22. And is he on 19, Aubameyang?
20,
so it is two off, yeah. I've just have sort of got an inkling that he's had his eye on that all season, and coming off the back of a hat trick, I wonder if he'll be wanting to play. I mean, ultimately, it won't be his decision, will it?
No. Although he could express his desire to play to Unai Emery, who might well be open to giving him that chance.
But also, how many chances is he going to get in a game if we put him out there with 10 kids, you know?
Well, that's it. I mean, I don't think he is going to play 10 kids. I think he will play a sort of fringy team, but will he play 10 kids? I don't think he can. You know, who's he playing left back?
I'm just having a look at the league table. So we are 1 point ahead of Manchester United. Their final game is at home to Cardiff. So
right,
you
so
have to
winning.
Think... they'll be winning that. And I think Emery will want to finish as high up the table as possible, despite his frustrations at not making top four. So
yeah,
I agree it's not going to be a team of kids. I think, you know, it might be a bit of an El Neni game, you know. But there's a long time between this match and the final. So it wouldn't surprise me if he takes a couple of chances.
Yeah, there's a £1.5 million difference in prize money between finishing in fifth and sixth. So if we finish, you know, if we drop points and United go above us, we finish sixth, and that's £1.5 million, which doesn't sound like a huge amount of money in the grand scheme of things, but it's still something that could go into the pot or pay Mesut Ozil's wages for a month, month and a week, you know. So there's that demand as well. So I think the length of time between... well, I would definitely be inclined, just out of sheer panic and the doom bells in my head going off about important players getting injured, I personally would be inclined to rest anybody that's important. But I don't think that's what Unai Emery will do or how he will approach it or how he'll even be thinking about it.
Yeah, I think he will rest the likes of Koscielny. I think he might rest a Monreal. You know,
well, Kolasinac came off injured, so he may have no choice but to play Monreal.
That's true. Was it an injury? It looked like cramp to me, Kolasinac, but I don't know.
I think he got a kick in his arse, and I don't quite know.
I think Torreira...
on. 1 second, okay. James. Someone's at the door. 1 second.
All right.
Hang on.
Hopefully he puts the music in this bit.
Hi, I'm back.
Hello.
Hello.
All well?
Yeah, all well. Do you know what actually happened today, which is weird? Twice what? A seagull has landed on the window outside my office, started pecking at the glass, and then fucked off.
Interesting.
I'm kind of, or something. Yeah,
terrifying.
I'm kind of scared. Like, is he stress testing the window pane?
Is it the same seagull?
Yeah. He's white. That's how I know.
Yeah, yeah. Must be.
Must be the same one. Wow. Anyway, what were we talking about?
We were talking about Burnley and what we think the team will be. And I was saying I think Lucas Torreira might be another who's rested, just because I feel like he's been nursed through a little bit.
Mm.
And he came off early against Valencia. And didn't play, did he, the Premier League game? The first leg he didn't play.
So let's try and pick a team. I think he'll pick Leno. I think it'll be...
Mustafi.
Maitland-Niles. I think he's going to play a back four. I think it'll be Mustafi. And maybe he'll play Mavropanos.
Yeah, and Monreal.
Monreal. And I think we could play midfield of... I think it might be Elneny, Guendouzi and Xhaka.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think he's going to play Iwobi, Mkhitaryan, because he's not going to play Mesut Ozil in Burnley, is he? Mesut doesn't go that far anyway. He doesn't go up that.
I mean, maybe he'll play Nketiah. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe he'll give him. Yeah. And he could have one of them on the bench or both the strikers on the bench.
Yeah.
I'd be happy enough with that because, like, basically, who gives a fuck about this game? I know there's £1.5 million, but
yeah, who needs it?
No, man.
I think that sounds about right.
Mm.
I think there's an outside chance someone like Joe Willock gets a game because he's just been on the fringes of the squad, hasn't he? And, and been on the bench a few times. But yeah, I think we'll see Mavropanos. I think we might see, might be a farewell appearance for Lichtsteiner. You never know.
Mm.
Mm.
Did he not have that the other day
yeah,
at Burnley?
Yeah, the guard of honour. so yeah, I will see. I mean, if I'm honest, it's a game I can barely be bothered to watch.
Yeah,
especially with interesting things going on in the title race. I feel like I'll probably have one eye on that game and one eye on things elsewhere. But really, it's all about the final now. Yeah. I noticed Chelsea are going away. You know, they are. They're off on to play a friendly in America between the last Premier League game and the Europa League final.
No way, really?
Yeah.
Are they...
And Sarri's not happy about it. It's been arranged for a while. I think it's for charity. But, yeah, it's been in their calendar, I think, for some months now. And he's given out about it. And I'm delighted. It seems like a sort of a needless distraction. So...
If I was Sarri, which I'm not, I would pick just 11 kids... from the academy and say, fuck that, we've got to, you know, imagine if they play Hazard and he picks up an injury against, who are they playing? Who are they playing in the US?
I'm not sure. Let's have a look.
Chelsea.
Post-season friendly in the US. It's an American team, as I recall. Yes.
The
New
Kalamazoo Doodle Hoppers.
That's it. It's the Kalamazoo Doodle Hoppers. AKA the New England Revolution.
Right.
Just 3 days before the final.
What? That's fucking... I'm sorry. I mean, I'm glad that it's happening from our point of view, but it's...
I mean, I'll be amazed if it goes ahead.
Me too. It'll be absolutely fucking stupid.
Or maybe they'll just send kids. Like, do you know what I mean? They literally won't send the first team.
Yeah.
I don't know. Fingers crossed they all go to America and...
Yeah.
I don't know
what either, but, you know, yeah, exactly. Injure themselves. Okay, I have got a question here, and it comes from somebody whose name I can't remember because I can't find it. God almighty. Oh, just this one here from Niranjan R. Kulkarni, who says, season player ratings for all the squad players and the manager from you guys? Yes, but watch out for that. That'll be on arsblog.com next week. We'll do an end of season player ratings and manager rating post on the website rather than on the podcast. Maybe we can do one on the podcast as well, but that will be coming up on arsblog.com next week, so watch out for that. The question that I have, which I can't find... Okay, here it is. from Peter Hoost, who's at Peter Hoost, who says, "Goodly morning, gents. Is Emery's first season a success if we win in Baku and not if we don't?"
Yes.
And yes.
Should I say yes? I mean, ultimately, if he wins the trophy in Baku, he has done what he was asked to do.
He's done something that Arsene Wenger could never do, which yes. is win a European trophy.
Now look, obviously I appreciate it's not as black and white as
yes,
all that.
Yes, of course, I know.
And there have been good and bad things in this season. But I think if we manage to squeak into the Champions League this season, we all have to look upon that as a success. I had this question from CY Guna on Twitter saying, "Do you think Emery is a second season manager? He was poor at PSG in first season, then won the treble. He has got good results against big teams but underestimated the mid-table teams. If he adds a few of his players and treats all with respect, do you think he could do better next year?"
Well, I mean, the one reservation I would have about that is, you know, if he could add his players. That's not the thing that gives me a great deal of confidence, because Denis Suarez was one of his players and that didn't work out. And I'm not sure, you know, he was the right fit for us anyway, even if he'd stayed fit. Mm-hmm. Could he be a second season manager? Look, if he can maintain the kind of level of performance that he's got us to in the big games against the big teams and also Tottenham, and improve where we've been weak, then certainly we could make progress. If we have Champions League football, if we can invest properly in the squad, you can see how it would be feasible for us to be better next season than we have been this season. I don't think that's, you know, an outrageous thing to say. I do think it really depends on what happens in this final, though. I think how Emery's first season is judged rests on this game. You know, if we win, we can not necessarily forget the way we blew the top four, but it becomes less relevant because we are where we want to be. But if we don't win, then I'm afraid that comes swimming back into very sharp focus and raises a lot of questions about how the season can be judged. Judge me in May. Well, we're in May now, and, you know, if this season were ending without a European final, I don't think you could say it was a success.
No.
So it is what it is. It's on the final, and it's on what we do in the final, you know?
Yeah, I suppose the only thing I would say is that if we don't win the final, I don't think that transforms it from success to abject failure. I just think it means we didn't get what we want. That's my opinion. You know, there has to be a middle ground.
No, I agree with you. I mean, abject failure is finishing mid-table.
Seventh or something. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
But again, we come back to the context of the Premier League failure. That's, you know, that's not a factor we can ignore, I don't think, because we were in a position to do something quite good in Premier League terms. I think we were reading back, myself and Andrew Allen, we were reading back over the season. Remember, we did a post on the website, myself, yourself, Tim, and Andrew and myself. We all wrote something about what we expected from the season. And it was basically, if he can finish in the top four, then that will be absolutely a successful season. Because, just because that would be an amazing thing to do with this particular squad. There's a great line here that I have to I have to dig out, because it's really very funny. Hang on one second.
No problem.
You keep talking there for a minute while I...
No, I was just going to say, I suspect I probably must have said something along those lines, because, you know, I didn't think it was particularly likely. But you're right. I mean, having had it sort of on a plate, to not get it is hugely frustrating. And it is kind of absurd that the perception of an entire season will come down to one game, but that is the nature of cup finals. And to a certain extent, it doesn't matter how we win it. It doesn't matter the style we play with in the final, which might suit Emery. It's just about the result of this time.
Yeah, it is. It was quite funny to read back on the post. I'll stick it in the show notes, the link to it. I'll stick it in the show notes so you can click on it from your podcast app and have a look. But we all expressed some serious concerns about, you know, our defence. And those were borne out. But I like this. You say, I suspect there will be plenty of positives this season. We'll surely be more robust away from home. So we know who to blame now. We know who to blame.
And at the start of the season, it seemed like I was going to be right. But then those chickens really came home to roost in horrific fashion. Well, don't ask me what's going to happen next season. That's for sure. I don't know.
No.
What about this question?
Okay.
I know it may not be my turn, but it seems relevant. So we talked about Emery's second season and the possibility of his players and what happens in the summer. Well, Gaz Arsenal asks, what are your thoughts on Edu taking the technical director role? Is this more about his links with Kia Jurabchian than his knowledge of Brazilian football, given how difficult it is for South Americans to get a visa here? If so, what do you think about us dealing with super agents? I'd just broaden the question, really, to be like, what was your reaction to the Edu story?
Well, I'm pleased we're doing something. Because it's a role that very badly needs to be filled. I think Edu has done pretty good work in the past and with the Brazil national team. It's a different kind of job, of course, coming to Arsenal and being technical director. I think the number of intelligent, successful administrators in the world of football is much smaller than we would like. You know, Manchester United have had 7 years of Ed Woodward, for goodness sake. So even the biggest clubs in the world are finding it hard to attract, you know, high quality staff. Edu might be a bit of a jump into the unknown, a bit of a gamble, but, you know, he knows the club. He knows the club in an era when success was demanded. You know, there were big characters in that squad and people who didn't accept second best. And I'm not saying that they're, you know, that's the culture at Arsenal right now, but, you know, we've spoken many times about it. Is the desire for success as strong as it was in the past? I'm not quite sure. You know, it feels like things have become more comfortable. So on that basis, I'm happy that we're giving somebody the job, that he's got a connection to Arsenal is quite interesting. I think there's something really quite interesting happening with Freddie Ljungberg as a coach. I could be wrong. It's just a gut feeling I have, a gut feeling. So, you know, something plays into that, you know, with Edu, former Invincible, Freddie Ljungberg as well. Maybe that's something that we're going to build for the future. But look, we have to get that role filled. There's some talk that he's agreed the deal since March, which doesn't really tally considering we were trying to appoint Monchi back then. But the worry, I suppose, I have is that how much is he going to be involved in this summer?
Depends what you believe, I guess, because, you know, we're said to be on the verge of signing, is it Martinelli, a young Brazilian winger? Difficult to imagine he's not been in some capacity involved.
Yeah, and it's, you know, you'd have to think he is. He says he's focused on the Copa America with Brazil, which I'm sure he is, but if there are discussions going on with Arsenal, maybe he is driving or helping to drive some of our transfer business and transfer targets. I'd just like to see whoever it is come in and be given the responsibility, you know, and come in and someone who's allowed to make changes and do things differently. Because at the moment, I think we're relying on far too much of what came before. People who've been there for a very long time, which isn't to say that they're terrible at doing their jobs, but, you know, it feels like that part of the club could do with a good refresh. And we had that with Sven, and he's gone. So yeah, I'm happy enough if Edu comes in. Let him get on with his work, and hopefully he can make a big impact. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting appointment. I think I'm sure Tim Steelman will write about this over the coming weeks and months. But I think his work at Corinthians was was decent enough. He's someone who's got ties not just in South America, but in Spain too. Of course, he played for Valencia, so he presumably has connections there. I do think it's interesting that we've gone for someone with a knowledge of the South American market, because Monchi fitted that bracket too. When you look at his major signings for Sevilla, you're looking at people like Dani Alves, Julio Bautista, you know, people who came from South America and made a massive impact in Europe. And, you know, maybe that's an area where if we can find a way around those visa regulations, we might be able to get a bit of a competitive edge on some of our rivals. And that's something we might need. You know, Arsene Wenger gave that in France 20 years ago. And if Eddie's able to do something similar, that would be fantastic. I think as well with these visa regulations, you know, oftentimes Brazilians are able to qualify by hook or crook, but via Spanish or Italian passports. I think the guy Martinelli we're talking about might be getting an Italian passport. And who knows as well what will happen to those visa regulations for non-EU workers when everything happens with Brexit. Things might shift a little bit. So I'm not too worried about that. And if he's got links with Jurabchian, I think, unfortunately, the reality is that Arsenal will have to work with these super agents. And we've started that process already. You see what it's done for someone like Wolves, who are firmly in bed with Jorge Mendes. So I think Arsenal are going to have to accept that this is the world that football is now, and we're going to have to deal with those guys. And if Edu's someone with the clout and the connections to do that, that's probably a good thing.
Do you see the story about Mino Raiola potentially being banned from doing any transfer business this summer? So if Arsenal wanted to move Henrik Mkhitaryan, it might complicate that. I'm not saying it would be impossible. Look, you know, I do worry a little bit about us getting into bed with these big agents when we're a club with a relatively limited transfer budget, because the big agents take big fees. And it'll be interesting to see a year from now. Sure. Don't they normally... There is a publication or a list of things published.
Yeah, they do publish.
Where they say this is how much each club has paid to agents. So we'll wait and see, you know, what happens there, if that's the thing. But I suppose when you are dealing with, if you want big players, then that's part and parcel of it. One of the things I did hear was that a lot of our targets for this summer are young players.
Right.
Young players who aren't going to cost an absolute bomb. So I don't see us going out and buying anyone of the stature of an Ozil or a Mkhitaryan or Aubameyang or anybody like that. I think we are going to try and identify emerging talent, developing talent who can fulfill their potential with us, and hopefully integrate them with experienced players who can help them along. So
I think that's exciting, and I think that's what we have to do. I think we have to, really. If you look at the age profile of our squad, if you look at, you know, historically how many times we've bought players and then lost them for a fraction of that value, we have to invest in youth. And whether that means Torreiras, so people in their early 20s who already have a bit of a profile and are ready to step straight into the first team, or whether it means, you know, teenagers who might arrive and sort of, you know, have to bide their time a little. I think that's an encouraging sign. And I think we made a lot of signings, didn't we, in the last couple of years, who were sort of 28, 29, 30. Mm. At some point, we have to balance that out.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay, let's have one final question before we go. And we're going back to Baku when Chelsea turn up with half a squad because they've been beaten by the Kalamazoo Doodle Hoppers. All their players are on crutches and what have you. Nevertheless, they somehow managed to hold us to a draw. Who would be your five penalty takers if it goes to a shootout in the final?
Wow. Okay. Assuming everyone is on the pitch.
Yeah.
I would have Aubameyang and Lacazette.
Yeah.
Without much thought. I think I would have Granit Xhaka. Even though he's got miss written absolutely all over him, hasn't he?
He does.
I think I'd have Lucas Torreira.
Okay.
I mean, it's not easy, you know. It's not easy with this
Arsenal team. Not.
And I think my fifth taker would be Nacho Monreal. I'm not saying he would be fifth in the order, but I think in terms of his technical level and his composure, I think he'd be in for me. What about you?
Yeah, Aubameyang, Lacazette, Monreal, Torreira, and then I'm kind of a little bit stuck. However,
who's in your head? Ozil?
Aaron Ramsey's in my head. Aaron Ramsey.
Aaron Ramsey, of course.
Coming onto the pitch with half an hour to go, hits the post, forces a great save from Kepa. But this is his moment. This is his Vieira against Manchester United moment, James. He steps up with a penalty to win a cup for Arsenal, having scored a winner in a cup final against Hull, a winner in a cup final against Chelsea. Here it is. This is his moment. He steps up. He blasts the ball into the top corner. He falls to the ground. His hamstring is no longer connected to anything in his leg. But it doesn't matter. The players carry him high on their shoulders. Our Welsh Jesus has won the Europa League for us. That's who I've got in my head.
A beautiful image. And if he doesn't make it, Petr Cech to take the fifth penalty, smash it into the top corner.
Oh, my goodness. Imagine.
Throw his helmet into the crowd. It would be a beautiful, beautiful sight.
It sure would. Petr Cech's helmet
on the subject
and
of
the
Baku,
Europa League.
By the way.
Go on, yeah.
one final question, which comes from Stephen Barr on Twitter. And Stephen says, do you think it's any coincidence that UEFA have chosen a location for the Europa League final that rhymes with fuck you? I just have to say, I feel desperately sorry for the fans travelling. It's incredibly expensive, incredibly tricky. There are only 6,000 tickets allocated.
It's absurd, isn't it? It really is absurd.
It is a complete joke. And I think it's I understand they've got to move the final around. I understand they've got to share it and, you know, shift it to different parts of Europe, in inverted commas. Mm. Fair enough. But the allocation and the transport issues are just so problematic for fans. And I honestly take my hat off to those Arsenal fans who will be making
it. It's a horrendous trip. I was looking at flights last night and they're all via Russia or Turkey. I had to go to, you know, from Dublin anyway, you would have had to go to Istanbul and then go to, there was somewhere.
It's the same, it was two changes.
Yeah. You know, so no, it is an awful destination for a final, particularly between two London clubs. The ticket allocation is an absolute disgrace. It really is. And also, I saw some of the prices for the Champions League final tickets. Holy fuck. Some of them are like £500. It's like, what the... I mean, I know it's the biggest game of football in the world and what have you, but like, fuck's sake. And you know, it is a perhaps an old trope to say, you know, football is nothing without the fans, but they seem to make decisions that take fans inside the stadium for granted more and more and more. And that goes from, you know, the location of this particular game to the way that VAR is implemented and what have you. And, you know, they're going to push the game towards a breaking point, you know, sooner rather than later if they keep this up. They don't listen to anybody. And, you know, the atmosphere at that game will suffer because of the fact it is where it is. And most of the people there will be neutral / corporate fans. You know, I know a lot of Arsenal fans and a lot of Chelsea fans will get tickets, you know, by hook or by crook. And a lot of the ones that went out for ballot will probably go on the black market. And some people will get rich selling those tickets. It's just awful. It really is. So there you go. Yeah. No doubt that's something we'll talk about a bit more in the weeks ahead.
We'll have plenty of time. First, Burnley.
First, Burnley. And just one final one. Avi Bunjan, who's at Avi Bunjan, says, Dennis Bergkamp is 50 today. What was your favourite moment from the Dutch maestro?
Oh, I mean, we did a whole podcast, didn't we, for the Patreon, which is definitely worth listening to if you haven't
Yeah, a really good one.
Dennis Bergkamp's finest moments his entire Arsenal career, we talked about, really. I think I picked my favourite Bergkamp goal as the goal against Sunderland. Is that the one I mean, or is it Barnsley? I forget.
I think I picked the one against Sunderland. Maybe you picked a different one,
maybe
did you?
Maybe I picked that. I can't remember. Listen back to it. You'll have to see. I mean, there are so many to choose from.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, look, there's so many great goals. The Newcastle goal is another one.
Yeah.
Oh, just countless, really.
Countless.
Happy birthday, Dennis.
Happy birthday. What an impact he had on this football club. And that is, you know, that is something we talk about. We go through his entire Arsenal career. So if you're not a Patreon member, sign up and listen to that. Patreon.com/arseblog. There's also one there on Robert Pires as well. There's more to come, actually, in that series about the players. So that's it. We will talk on Monday after the all-important Burnley game on Sunday. But I'm very happy and delighted that we've had a mostly upbeat podcast, and getting to a European final is a great thing. It's been fun to share something good with you.
Yes, it has, and with you at home as well. Thanks for listening through the torturous, difficult ones.
Yes.
And it's lovely that we've all got something to celebrate. Let's hope we have even more to celebrate come the 29th of May.
Absolutely. All right, folks, we'll leave it there. We will catch you on the next one. Have yourselves a great weekend. And here's to a 7-0 win over Burnley and Tottenham losing 3-0 to whoever the fuck it is they're playing.
Frank de Boer speelt de bal. Heel goed naar Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp neemt de bal aan. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp. Dennis Bergkamp.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.